Welcome to VI Talk, sharing ideas, information, and support.
Hi everyone, it's Jo, and I've got with me Dawn.
Hi.
And I have a friend of mine who went to college with both Dawn and I years and years ago, showing our age here, the lovely Mr. Paul Leishman. Hi, Paul.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm all right, thank you.
Our ages now, folks.
I know.
Yeah. I was just about to say, during the war.
No, not quite that old. Okay, so we're going to talk to Paul about his music career, really. So do you want to tell us? Well, first I'll start by saying that Paul has no sight at all, do you?
No. I had sight until I was about... Well, I had some sort of vision, although it was registered blind until I was about sort of late teens, early 20s, although I was born with pretty good sight, and I had sight in one eye until about, well, I lost sight in one eye when I was six, and then I had very good sight in the other eye until I was about 13. I had a detached retina, and then, so I was at mainstream school then, and before I went to boarding school in Coventry, Exhall Grange.
Lucky boy.
Apparently so. Well, anything would have been an improvement on going to the comprehensive near me, I can assure you that. But well, my middle school was pretty good. The little schools were good. But once you start getting to the comprehensive, you're all going to be shoddy after that.
Yeah. So when did you develop an interest in music? Were you always, even, you know, when you had fairly good sight?
No, not really. No, I was into football and sports. And there was a guy down the road. He had this massive organ. That he had in his house, and I used to walk to school with his daughter about the age of seven, and I remember seeing that and being quite transfixed by it and things like that. So I think that was in my mind. What it was for me was going to Exhall Grange, really, was the thing, because, I mean, the only thing we had at school was maybe a little recorder and a xylophone, you know, to have a little tinkle on. Between playing Adam Ants when the teachers weren't there. So, you know, it wasn't the place to go, normal state school. Unless you've met parents, pay for your posh lessons. But, I mean, I was working class, but I was unemployed in the 80s with the factory years for a long time. So, you know, we weren't going to be doing any of that. So it was boarding school, really. It was the fact that our teacher was very forward-thinking. He'd got lots of synthesizers that he'd bought in and drum kit, and he had his own synthesizer, which was extremely expensive in the day. And we had very strange music lessons. They weren't like your usual ones. He'd turn up with this is a DX7 synthesizer, which you might not know what it is, but any record you heard from 1983 onwards to late 80s, early 90s, you would have heard those sounds from those machines. And he'd sit there and play these sounds. You think, this isn't really a music lesson, is it? You know, what happened to singing, you know, I don't know, Oh, Jesus Christ, or whatever we're going to do for a play, you know. He'd be playing these synthesizers, and they had these drum machines, and so, but I didn't realize it was an education, because, of course, they were, most schools were quite traditional, weren't they, in the way they taught music.
Yeah.
But people like him could see what was coming, and now, obviously, music, most music, in fact, all of it pretty much that you hear in mainstream is done on computers. There's no real instruments hardly at all now. Which arguably is sad depending on how you look at it. So it was that, really. He got all these synthesizers, and I first started playing the drums, and I said to my parents, I wanted a drum kit, and they said no because of the neighbours. So my teacher got a Casio keyboard for sale, and I said, I'll have that then. And they said, all right, then he'll give up that after a week, because it's a bit like Star Wars figures, and he won't carry him with that. Be a fad. But as soon as I got it, I was a keyboard player, although I couldn't actually play a note, but as far as I was concerned, I owned the keyboard, therefore I'm in the club. And that was it. So, and for some reason I just got obsessed with these synthesizers. So it's the synthesizer side of it, and fortunately we had some great you know, a couple of teachers, you know, and him, he was an excellent musician, that, and I was able to, you know, have a go playing the piano and as well. So we kind of started on the drums originally and went from there. And then obviously I did my O-levels, and I didn't want to stay at boarding school. The idea of doing that, I wasn't ready for it anyway, doing A-levels then. I wasn't in the zone, man, as they say.
I don't think anyone were.
I'm not sure I ever will be, or, you know, but at least I was aware I wasn't then. So then went to Hereford to do piano tuning because they seemed like that was a good thing. That's what you do when you're blind and you're a man and you like music. Well, go and send you and do piano tuning. And so I went to do that, and I didn't really want to do it as a job, if I'm being honest. Although I loved doing it as a course, I learned a lot from it. Because my first week of piano tuning in repairs, you're supposed to put string on, I took five off. And the teacher said, I think you need to learn some patience, Paul. So I learned about how to be methodical on that course because, you know, there's no way of doing. It's a very intense. You've got to listen all the time. You just can't switch off from it. And also you've got to play by the rules. And if you're not methodical, you won't get any results. And also, you know, a very open-minded music department. You know, the teacher, Mr. Beasley, was really open-minded. And and I spent every penny I got on the musical equipment again, you know, and yeah, so yeah, that was kind of where I went from there.
So you were in bands and things at RNC, weren't you?
Yeah, I'd always played, even at school, you know, even at boarding school, we'd play on stage with keyboards and my mate had a synthesizer because he was quite well off. That was the thing about boarding school. You suddenly realized there was a thing called a system and class because all the kids were from different backgrounds.
Yeah.
Whereas you don't realise that when you just come from a working class background other than what you see on the television.
Mm.
And then you realise that people have, you know, got access to all this money. And because of that, I'd be lucky enough to have people who could show me these things that I would have never seen else. So, yeah, we used to play live on stage and also outside the school. And then when I went to Hereford, I used to do a similar thing with a couple of guys who I was on the course with, Darren Hartland at the time and Sean McKinden. And we used to do things outside the college as well as inside.
Can I show how geeky I am? I know, it was cause and effect.
Yes, that was. I don't know who came up with that idea. I did try to pass it off on the band I had after I left college, and that was veto quickly for some reason.
Right.
It was quite trendy actually by those days' standards.
Yeah, yeah. Thought it was quite a good name.
They didn't agree. Maybe by 1990 it was a bit. Yeah, by 1990 it was obviously very passé.
So what happened after college?
Well, I went with Darren to do a BTEC nationally in sound, well, audiovisual design it was at the time. So it's kind of television and radio. And that was a very different experience because it was nothing like Hereford, because Hereford's very kind of, you don't touch this, you don't touch that. There's a certain element of, you don't do this until you reach a certain standard and all that kind of thing. Mm. Whereas mainstream education is very much a case of, here you are, get on with it. And if you fall on your face, well, adios, muchachos. Mm. You know, there's no effort to keep in the loop, so to speak. Maybe there is now, but there certainly wasn't then. So you had to learn that you're on your own, really, and you've got to network with people, especially when you can't see, to get things done and get computer assistance. But I did a lot of recording then because I built up my own equipment, and also doing stuff at the college because the people who taught there had, like the sound engineer used to be UB40's engineer, and so they got real experience outside in the real world. And I used to gig as well for one of the guys within the band I was in from college, and we used to do gigs as well locally. So yes, I did that for the 2 years, and then when I graduated from that, I got an award from Central Television for the best student, much to the annoyance of one other student who felt he should have got it. I think he felt, yes, well, there you go, politics for you. But I think he felt I was the token blind guy. I said, you know, that was my impression.
Am I right, if I done my homework right, that you and Darren were the first two blind people to do that course?
Yeah. Yes, and then I think Heidi McGough a year later, and I forgot what her boyfriend's name was at the time, which is terrible of me to forget that, but yeah, if it comes to me, I'll let you know. So she did that. It was really good, though. I mean, from terms of the equipment, they were excellent, you know, excellent, but it was a culture shock realising that you kind of, in mainstream college, you know, they're not going to handhold you, and if you don't turn up, well, they don't really care.
The onus is more on you.
Whereas Hereford was much more a kind of trade, more like learning a trade within a you know, being in a factory. It's more that kind of mentality.
Yeah.
Very much more, you know, much more like a proper business, if you like, because you would work for the college in the last 3 years. So they wouldn't have any nonsense. So you learned a level of respect for what you were doing. So I learned a lot from that because of that. But, you know, how to, so there were some advantages to that, definitely. You know, so, but it was, it was definitely rock and roll when I went to Sandwell. I mean, you just went out seeing bands at clubs and rock bands and all, it was, you know, part, you know, getting a few parties, that sort of thing. Not every night, but it was that type of thing.
So what happened after that? What was the next
step? Well, after that, I was kind of like, you know, oh dear. Well, as a lot of blind people do. Oh dear, what do I do now? So I was in the band. I used to play a lot though, weekends. You know, the money you used to get, you used to use to put towards your equipment. And then we was involved in a very, very serious accident about 6 months after I left college, which involved a death. The guy hit us. It wasn't anybody's fault particularly. So after that, for a year, so for about 6 months after I left, I was doing that, about 1991. Then at the end of 91, I had this accident. And so 92, I was kind of incapacitated a bit because of what happened. But I was still writing a lot with my friend from college. And also Heidi McGough started to, because she was in a relationship with him, was singing on some of our stuff. And about a year after that, we started going live a lot. So again, we were gigging every weekend pretty much, two times a week. And this went for a good couple of years. So on and off, I was always gigging. And I started my piano tuning business at the time, so I thought I'd better do something. So I did that. And then after, whilst I was doing that, I was this is kind of like the mid-90s, I was also doing some playing in commercial studios because, you know, somebody'd hear about you. You know, you play some piano in the music shop, rock a bit of boogie-woogie, and you get a call saying, come and play keyboards for us. And what used to happen was... a commercial studio, so they would have DJs that were coming who would be paid by an independent record company, usually tied to a nightclub, and they'd say, you know, here's $2,000, that's to pay for the recording, and here's a DAT tape, as he used to call it years ago, which would be a digital tape of some vocals, let's say Candy Staton, who did quite a few songs back in the day. I remember doing one of those, and then they'd come in and they would be paid for doing the remix a fee, and then the studio would pay a fee, and then obviously I would be paid a fee for playing, you know what I mean? So you're playing and programming synthesizers, because the facts of the matter were the DJs couldn't play.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm not saying they didn't have good ideas. Well, okay, an idea. But, you know, so the engineers would basically do their bidding, if you like, alongside people like me. So I did some of that as well. And then... also did stuff in London with a guy called Guru Josh, who'd had hits in the 90s. That was an interesting experience as well. That was with a guy who'd got a record contract, again, a DJ. He was pretty clued up, though. He was a proper DJ doing lots of, when I mean proper DJ, he knew how to create a track, you know what I mean? He wasn't just somebody. He wasn't a musician in the traditional sense that I would be. Depending on if you class me as a musician, that's up for grabs, I guess. But you know, he knew about, you know, how to program things, so he understood the mechanics of it, if you like.
Yeah.
Whereas other people, they didn't. They got ideas, but they needed you to convey those ideas. And then during that kind of whole mid-90s, I was also doing my own stuff. So I was recording singers, I guess, and then they'd go around, and then people hear about me, and then. I got a call from a guy who was managing a girl called Shaheen Badar, an Asian singer who sang for The Prodigy on Smack My Bitch Up and a few tracks, which of course caused a bit of a stir being an Asian girl. Feminists would love that these days. That was girl power then. It was different those days. Girl power. It was all right. So I started writing songs with her and stuff like that. But at the same time, I'd become interested in psychology and that because part of my accident, this was all going on in the, so I was doing three things, this bit of tuning, live work and some studio work and my own sort of individual things. And also because of my accident, I'd used the money to pay for a house. You know what I mean? I'd bought what was called ex-counselors, you know, the right to buy.
Yeah.
So I was comfortable then, if you catch my drift.
Yeah.
But I realized that if at some point you can't keep doing this forever, you know, as you start getting older, the music business is a young person's game, really. And also the internet was in its infancy. So we're sort of talking towards the late 90s as well. So I could see that because of my experience of piano tuning and the coal mines, and I could see that things were going to change, that the, you know, that this couldn't continue the way it was.
Yeah.
I explain what I mean by that. But I'll just go back to the business of the, I had to see a clinical psychologist part of my insurance claim, and, you know, because it's just what you have to do. And I remember sitting there thinking, you know what my problem is? You're doing very well and I'm not. Because this is just after the accident. This was just after the accident, you see. So things weren't going too well at that point.
Yeah.
And I just became interested in it, you know. And then I eventually I thought, I'll go and do some A-levels, because I always felt I should have done them at school. But as I said before, I wasn't in the zone. And I went to night school, did psychology and sociology. And then towards the late 90s, when the internet started, I started to focus more on that, on getting my psychology degree. So, but I was still doing a bit of piano tuning, obviously, because you've got to make ends meet as a student, haven't you? And then also I started messing around with this whole dot-com stuff at the time. You know, we're putting CDs up and stuff like that. And then after I finished my university degree in the early 2000s, I kind of met my wife at university, and she on the same course, and things had started to change. And so it went from being something I wanted to do as part of a living to something that became more of a hobby, if you like, because I moved away from my friends that I knew in that area. And also everything was moving towards downloads. You know, I could see this coming. So really, you know, big studios started to disintegrate, because what when people could do it all on their own, people were starting to use computers. So where you needed a whole room of, you know, £500,000 worth of equipment to do a record, if you wanted to do it to a, unless you know, to a top-notch standard, I'm just giving a ballpark figure, the sort of monies we're talking about, people could do it for like $5,000, you know. And people now, I mean, go on.
Big difference in price, though, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. It's what they call a democratization of music. What happened was that the costs came significantly down, but also the cost came down for the industry because it couldn't make as much revenue return, because there's no money in selling records anymore, because people just download them off the internet or pirate them or whatever. And there's too much supply, too many people making music. Once you open distribution up to the world, anybody can put their music up on Spotify or iTunes or SoundCloud or YouTube or iTunes. I said that one. I think I did. You know, anyway, all of the output, anybody can do that now, and there's no gatekeeping to the quality or anything like that. So when you've got an exponential growth of supply, let's say of housing, for argument's sake, and not enough buyers, well, the prices will drop. So similarly with the music industry, same happened. So they had to completely change their focus towards live work and merchandise. So, you know, I kind of had a gist of this was sort of happening, because obviously me and you on here, we're all just because we don't, you might not make music, you know, you still buy it, don't you? And you probably noticed you weren't doing so much of that anymore. You were just looking on your phone. So I still did a bit of playing live in bands in the early 2000s, but I started to work as a development worker then in Shropshire with hearing and visually impaired people, and the music started to take more of a kind of hobby orientation, if you like. But it's still part of something I do, you know, as a serious interest. I mean, I couldn't not do it if you catch my drift.
It'll always be a passion of yours, I think, won't it?
Part of you. Everybody needs a man cave. You know, some people have greenhouses outside. I just have guitars and things like that.
Can't be bad.
But, you know, and yeah, so that took more of a backseat. But I did start messing around with this is kind of like late 2000s, because I'd gone into business doing books and then property with my wife. So I'd gone in a completely different direction to where I'm a bit like that. I did the psych, I'd be a lecturer. Oh, no, I can't do this. I thought when you enter university, intelligent people got on, and I realised they're just as nasty, just clever at it. So I did. so I decided I can't do this, and I couldn't do, and I didn't like work in an office. So, you know, which is what part of what I did when I was in Shrewsbury, and, you know, So I decided that I'll just go it alone. And my wife's got that kind of background anyway. So,
yeah.
But I started messing around with the podcasting. So what you're doing there, kind of early days, you see, you're talking about mid-2000s.
Yeah.
And there's something called the PodSafe Music Network. So you could put all your music on there, and then people from around the world, who were just ordinary people, would put these podcasts up for people to listen to, put your music on it. So it's kind of punk ethic, you know, the old DIY ethic, make your own records and that.
Yeah.
And then obviously YouTube came along in about 2005, and I started doing that about 10 years ago, and I started putting all these videos up as synthesizers, and you're getting massive amounts of hits, you know, tens of thousands on synthesizers, because you realize, wow, there are nerds like me out there. None of them women, hardly. It's good for them, isn't it? They're probably got more sense. Yeah, and so that whole internet marketing thing I got interested in as a kind of hobby side of thing, but it does inform you about the way you, for instance, eBay or Amazon, people who sell, like I did books, and that, you start to understand the way the markets work, you know, and things like that. But I stopped doing that about 6-7 years ago because people would, you know, keep contacting you saying, you know, oh, I've got one of them. Why doesn't it work? And you can't tell anybody, look, it's got no batteries in it. I mean, that would help. So, you get some people are a bit like that, you know, I'm afraid to say it. And after a bit, I just thought, oh, I can't be doing this anymore. Yeah. It's not fun anymore. So I thought, oh. So I've been putting it on YouTube for some time. So I tend just to put stuff up on well, it was Audio Boom and things like that and SoundCloud. Yeah. But as we know, Audio Boom bit the dust. Yes, so that was my journey then, really.
So you still, because you were having guitar lessons, weren't you?
I still have guitar lessons. Well, I call it guitar rehabilitation because, you know, like typists get into bad habits.
Yeah.
Like, it's a bit like that. I get, you know, guitarists, they get into bad habits. Mm. Although, you know, and so there are certain ways, if you want to get the best out of playing, that you need to keep doing. So it's a bit like having a tennis coach, just because you may know a lot about it, you know, relative to most people, doesn't mean you still don't need somebody to say, well, actually, I think you're changing the way you play. Subtly, you know, you need to keep being reminded. You know, like when you was a kid, your mother said, keep your arms off the table. It's kind of like that, but for guitarists, you know, it's that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I still do that, yeah.
You've done loads of interesting stuff, haven't you? Because didn't you write some stuff for the, I can't think what it's called, for the cathedral?
Cathedral and that. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I've done lots of individual little projects along, you know, which I've, some of which have been paid to do, you know, like voiceovers, recording people acting voices and stuff like that. And,
yeah.
And Lichfield Cathedral, what they call them, mystery plays. So anybody who goes to church will probably know about them. Although I'm not religious myself, but they do them every few years. And Lichfield Cathedral, my friend Stuart, who's a bit of a thespian type, he's my best friend from uni. Very intelligent guy, and he's very much his background. He did psychology, but he did a lot of masters in drama, and he does a lot of local projects and things like that. So he asked me to. He would always turn up and ask me to do music things for him. So I did some of that sort of stuff, and that was weird because I did this kind of, I suppose sort of dancey kind of music, I guess, and it's in this literal, because it's booming through this cathedral, and this woman, as it finished, he's got these dancers jigging along to it, you know, and at the end of it, this woman turned around to her husband at the back, she went, well, that was different, wasn't it? So, yeah, I quite enjoyed that. There's something about that I kind of get a strange kick out of. But, so that was good. But he's strange, because he would turn up when he was doing his exams, and he'd turn up at, like, 12 o'clock at night when he's got to do the play tomorrow. Can you write me some music, Paul? What I want it to be, you know, like Blade Runner and Spartacus, if you could like mix that in. And so he's not a musician, so he'd want you to write these things in like 2 hours. You'd have gadgets that would do some of this stuff for you. There's certain things you can knock out in a couple of hours, which isn't very original, but it will do the job. If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
You know, like the theme tune.
You get him by.
Dun, 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 dun. I mean, it's not the greatest epic in the world, is it? But you do know it's Channel 4.
Yeah.
So it's one of them, as we say.
Yeah.
But the cathedral stuff is a bit more long, you know, it's a bit more effort involved.
So
I do things on and off.
So if somebody wanted to listen to some of your material, and what you're up to, because I know you do sort of demos and things, don't you? And sort of like you kind of play around and improvisation and stuff like that, don't you? So how can they do that?
Well, they can hand me over wads of cash first. Then they'd probably say, no, we don't think you're that interesting. Or alternatively, I could just go on my YouTube channel. It's www.youtube.com/Angelica's Baby, AngelicasBaby. Or you could just type in Paul Leishman, Paul space Leishman, and type in Angelica's Baby. You'll probably pick some videos up. And I've done quite a bunch of songs on there, which are mainly my stuff. They're a mixture of kind of demonstrations of equipment for us, you know, we're into this sort of thing. And also a mixture of my own songs, you know, the stuff I've done myself. And the SoundCloud, you can put in Angelica's Baby as one word, and then I think SoundCloud will pick lots of stuff up on there, which is a little more different types of things, and Audio Just Boom.
Because people are probably thinking, Angelica's Baby, where did that come from?
Well, okay. And why there's no apostrophe?
Well, there's always going to be people who are going to wonder, isn't there? So
the reason why there's no apostrophe, because people are going to go, why is no apostrophe? I go, because it was clever. Ooh. No. There's no apostrophe, because that wouldn't be very good as typing that into a YouTube, into a link, would it? You know, it's not easy to type into a web address. So it's pragmatic originally. Mm-hmm. But the original reason for it is that my friend who, Damien, who was a guitar player, learned a lot of my stuff from, who we did some stuff together, some of the original songs, and we called ourselves Angelica's Baby, but he sadly died very young. So I just kept the name, really, as a kind of memorial. Is that the right word?
Yeah.
Sounds really twee, doesn't it? But it isn't. That's why I did it. So I thought, you know.
Yeah.
So that's why I did it, really, kind of heads up, if you like.
And speaking of which, there's going to be a piece of one of your original pieces at the end of this interview.
Yeah, bring your guitar. Yeah, I chose something that wasn't too zany. Radio 2 friendly. But yeah, I did write it for my friend, which took originally on the piano, and then eventually, you know, it ended up being finished. I'm a bit slow these days. It might be my age. You know, when you get to 50, it's like my friend used to call it the eye of the tiger. You know, when you're young, you go, rah, rule the world. You know what I mean? And as you get older, you think, well, actually, I think I might just have like a glass of wine. Yeah. You know, watch the telly. So I finished it for about 4 or 5 years. But I wrote the lyrics about our time when we were unemployed, because he never seemed to care. He just didn't care about anything. He was extremely laid back. So obviously, as a blind person, getting jobs is a concern for us, isn't it? And it's something So it's about that kind of him having a very sort of laid back attitude towards things, and me having this need to do something, you know.
Is that your motivation, the need to do something to prove to people?
Probably, yeah. I don't think I'd have done a great deal if I'd stayed sighted. Let's be honest to myself here. Yeah. No, this is true.
You're very honest.
I'm lucky to be alive, let alone being honest. When I was younger, you know, I was such a little terror, apparently. I mean, somebody said to my mother and father once, well, I know your son's lost his sight, but, you know, let's face it, the way he used to be, he'd be dead otherwise, wouldn't he? You know, so words like that. So, I mean, I wasn't there, but that was the kind of gist of it, you know. Well, if your son wasn't playing chicken with no brakes on his bikes with his friends, you know, eventually something was going to happen. So, yeah, arguably narrow escape. Yes, I think that. Yes, I do think that's a lot to do with it. Yeah, I think there is. I don't bother about it so much these days. And also, there's that working class, you know, which is being. Well, I won't.
It's a work ethic, isn't it? That you.
Well, there's the working class. There's the not being able to see. There's my dad's unemployment, you know, in the early 80s, and of course, to some people, that doesn't mean a lot, great deal now, because. You know, we're even getting into the ideas of there isn't such a thing as a man or a woman anymore. We're moving into kind of, it's a completely different topic. But what I'm trying to say is that these traditional things, the breadwinner things, it's probably toxic. I don't know. Mm. There you go. Who knows? But that was probably the motivation for it.
Yeah. Well, thank you ever so much, Paul.
Yeah, you're probably going, we're not having him on again. Oh, God.
No, but we don't. It's been a pleasure. It's been brilliant.
Yeah. Thank you very much indeed. Appreciate it.
Yes. Same to you.
You can email us info@vitalk.co.uk. Our Twitter handle is VI Talk Podcast. Our Facebook is VI Talk. And our website address is www.vitalk.co.uk. Now here is a song from Paul, track entitled Bring Your Guitar.
Bring your guitar with you, like you used to do. Let's take the blue van and go for a drive. We'll buy some cheap beer to pass the time by. We'll sit on that bridge where we used to go. You'll sing silly songs that nobody knows. Bring your guitar with you, like you used to do. You made me laugh, you made me cry, you made me mad, though I never knew why. I'd knock your door four times a day, but you were out, what you'd always say. You were out, what you'd always say. You were out, what you'd always say. You were out, what you'd always say.
Bring your guitar with you, like you used to do. We had no money, we had no job. You thought it was funny, at the time I did not. It's 5 years now since you passed away. It's taken this long for me to say. Bring your guitar with you, like you used to do. Guitar with you, like you used to do. The one you brought second hand, I still got it, you'd understand.